thank you for coming. I'm sorry it's a bit crowded. Although there's lots of Green Party stuff out here, and this has been arranged by the Green Party, the talk I shall give you, I've been giving up and down the country for the last 2 years, and it's not particularly a Green Party talk. It's about the TTIP. And all the things I shall tell you are things you can look up yourself, because all publicly available information, and I do urge you to look it up rather than take my word for it. Because once you've looked it up, you'll know it's true. And you won't leave yourself the excuse of saying, oh, that can't be true, he just made that bit up. Once you've looked it up, you'll know it's true. Someone just asked me what my background was, so I suppose I should tell you. My background, I spent the last 20 years making science documentaries for BBC, Channel 4, and most recently BBC 4. So that's the day job. So I have a soft science background. My degree is in science. And I started writing about finance and where finance overlaps with politics in 2007, when the present debt crisis started to unfold. And for a couple of years, I just wrote furious and irate comments on the online Guardian beneath articles. Became quite well known in that community of people, and was asked several times if I'd start a blog. I originally said no, because the world didn't need another blog. And anyway, I don't like blogging. It's an ugly word, and it's populated by people who say, ooh, listen to what I have to say. And I thought, do I want to be that person? But in the end, people asked me several times, and I did, and now I write a financial blog, which has become one of the country's larger financial blogs. But that means I'm just self-taught. I have no letters after my name to do with economics at all. I do not have a degree in economics. On the other hand, I don't have a degree in astrology either. And neither one of these things keeps me up late at night worried, because mainstream economics is largely hokum. And even the economists know this. And also, I'm interested in finance, how it actually works, not what it says in the squeaky clean, idealized economic textbooks. Because I do talk regularly to senior bankers, CEOs, traders, and there's two groups of people that people in finance snigger at. One is politicians, and the other is economists. Anyway, so that's my background. The title of the talk is The Death of Democracy. And it is, I realize it is one of those titles where you think, well, that's just a bit over the top. I hope by the end of this talk, you'll think it's not at all over the top. I think part of the problem is we've been all born into our democracy. And so it's very easy to just think, well, it's the natural state of affairs. Once you've got a democracy, well, what could go wrong? The thing about democracy is it's very hard to get. Blood had to be shed to get our democracy. But giving it away is extremely easy. Giving it away just can happen at the stroke of a pen. And my point is our democracy, our sovereignty, has been given away and is increasingly being given away by a small number of people. I'll talk about three things, one of which you've heard about, I think, and two you won't have. And the reason for the three things is they are nested inside each other. The thing you'll have heard of is the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. It's the big trade deal. But there are two things nested inside it, which I'll come to, which change the nature of what a trade deal is about. All right, so the outside doll, the trade agreement, what it's set up to do is what trade agreements have been trying to do for the last 20 years, going back before the World Trade Organization, which is to lower trade and tariff barriers, give access to foreign companies to our markets, and our companies having access to their markets, and to what they call harmonize regulations. The two areas that the Americans are particularly concerned with, when you read the documents that have been submitted to the American negotiators, the two areas of trade they're particularly interested are agricultural foodstuffs and health. The last estimate I saw from the American food lobby is they reckoned the size of the trade which they could get, they think, for our agriculture and food products was $300 billion. That's what they reckoned was on offer for them. The reason that they want this trade deal to go through is because they have not, American corporations have not had access to our food and agricultural markets, because the way we regulate these things and the way the Americans do are really, they couldn't be any more different. In Europe, the regulations were basically formalized in about 2006. And it's what's called the precautionary principle, which you may have heard of. It's also called from farm to fork. And in essence, what it says is if you want to sell someone a chicken that's fit to eat, then you make sure it's fit to eat from the point at which it was an egg through to the point at which it arrives on someone's table. So you don't allow it to become infected with something like salmonella. So the emphasis is on reasonable standards of animal care, reasonably sanitary conditions under which it's bred and slaughtered. Now, I'm not saying that we have wonderful conditions for the animals that we raise and slaughter and eat, but compared to the Americans, they are wonderful. So the European regulations are keep the animals in a reasonable condition, don't allow them to become infected, and then when they get to the stage where they're being packaged up and sold, they're not infected. They weren't infected back there. They're not infected at this stage. Now, the Americans have a completely different set of an idea of how you regulate this. Their law goes back to 1976, and I think it's fair to say that the American agricultural business has been at pains to make sure that 1976 legislation was never updated. And essentially, you can keep animals in any old condition you like. I'm exaggerating, obviously, but awful conditions which we wouldn't allow in Europe, and chicken, for instance. And then at the final step, when it's been killed and it's being ready to be packaged up, they douse it in chlorine to kill everything. Right. So, and to give you an example, on the meat, chicken is the one I use just because there's lots of information about it. When the carcasses go through on the final stage, they go through on a conveyor belt, and people are standing there, and they have to check the chicken for feces and malformation. Malformation means cancer, basically. And they go through at a rate of 140 a minute. And people do 8-hour shifts. So you go, okay, that was okay. Okay, that was okay. Okay, that's okay. Okay, that's okay. And that one. And that was okay. Oh, and that was not. Try doing that for 8 hours. Right. And they decided that they would relax the conditions, the regulations. So now they've gone up to 175 a minute. So that's a third of a second. So those are the differences. I won't even go into how they keep pigs, in case anyone here is squeamish. But suffice to say that one of the pig shit lagoons exploded a while ago, and you could hear the explosion several miles away. They pump all the shit into vast lagoons, which are, I think some of the big ones are 4 times the size of Wembley Stadium and 30 feet deep. And they're coming to a neighborhood near you if the TTIP goes through. So there is this huge difference. Now, when you hear from the government and when you hear from the negotiators, in fact, I had a debate with our MP, Robert Goodwill, and he trotted out the line which they said, no, this is wrong. They're not going to lower standards. It's just not right. The Americans will keep their standards and we'll keep our standards and it'll carry on. Okay, so everything's going to remain as it was before. My question is then why, if that's true, why do we need the trade agreement? And how is that going to help the Americans? How is that going to help anyone if nothing changes? What, if a European chicken provider has to have this set of regulations, which are more onerous and more expensive, and the Americans have their own, they're going, our chicken producers are going to go out of business, aren't they? So that's either a lie, what they're saying, which I suspect it is, or they'll let it go through and all our chicken people will go out of business and they'll all petition Parliament and they'll say, this is dreadful, you've got to help us, and Parliament will come before you and say, oh, we're just going to have to, you don't want all our chicken people to go out of business, do you? No, of course you don't. So why don't we lower the regulations to be like the Americans, so that they're competitive? Okay, take your pick which one of those two eventualities it's going to be. And if you can think of a third one, let me know. But I don't think there is one. So Goodwill trotted this out, and I gave him the answer I just gave him, and he said nothing. For the simple reason he has nothing to say. They will also say, no, it's not to do with that. It's all to do with lowering tariffs, you know, these dreadful tariffs. He said that too, and that's a lie. The European Commission's own research, when they put together a document showing what the TTIP would do, their own document, not mine, not Greenpeace's, the EU's, said 80% of the potential benefits would not come from lowering tariffs, but would come from removing non-trade barriers. Non-trade barriers are regulations and standards, the things we were just talking about. So they are the things that are going to go. Otherwise, by the EU's own admission, there wouldn't be any benefit to it. So that is the outside doll. And it is going to be an erosion of standards and of regulations. There's just no two ways about it. If those things aren't true, there's zero point in having the trade agreement at all. So it's not a great thing, in my opinion, and will not really help you, except maybe give you some really shitty cheap chicken. However, inside the trade agreement, there is something called a bilateral investment treaty, which very few people have heard of, but it is very important for this reason. That kind of trade agreement I've just discussed, they've been trying and they have been putting them forward since the World Trade Organization, since 1996 at the very latest. And there have been various versions of trade agreements, lowering barriers and all the barriers to trade and all the rest of it. But there's always been one problem, a major problem for the corporations involved, and that is, how do you force a nation to stick to it? And more importantly, how do you force a nation to stick to it when every 4 or 5 years the government changes? Because what they noticed in previous trade agreements is people would merrily sign up to it with big fanfare and flashing lights, and people would shake hands and it would be in all the newspapers. And then when it didn't suit the country, they would kick it into the long grass. There are disagreements between America and China that have been rumbling on for 6, 7 years. Because there's endless ways in which a government can just say, oh yes, of course we're getting to it, and then not get to it. And what are they going to do? And corporations don't like it. So the corporations in the 90s basically said, that kind of old trade agreement, the World Trade Organization thing, just doesn't work. Because it's endlessly, you know, being avoided and kicked into the long grass, and nothing happens that benefits us, the corporations. We want a way to force nations to stick to the lowering of tariffs or the opening of markets, no matter what changes of government might happen. And I don't know if any of you have ever heard of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. It was the first, please come in, it was the first of this new kind of trade agreement, which the TTIP is one of them. And what happened in NAFTA, some bright spark said, if we put a bilateral investment treaty inside the trade agreement, put it inside there, this solves our problems. How? I'll tell you how. A bilateral investment treaty is a small piece of international law which was quite obscure. The first one was signed in 1959 between Germany and Pakistan. And what they do is really quite simple. They say, if a foreign company invests in your country, and then you do this, your country changes its mind or does something the company doesn't like, the company has the right to sue your entire nation. Right? That's the power that a bilateral investment treaty gives. It's an extraordinary power when you think about it, but that's what it does. The reason they started being signed in 1959 was because corporations would say, here we are, we're investing in these third world countries, and these third world countries keep on having revolutions and burning down our factories, and nobody, and we don't get any recompense. So we need this extra protection that a bilateral investment treaty gives us. There were very few of them. Very few were signed. There was no case was brought where a company sued a nation until 1986. So you can see how obscure they were. First one signed in 59, nothing happens until 1986. There were very few of them. However, that changed quite a lot. By 1996, there'd still only been 38 cases. Because if you think back to 1996, that was when corporations were still pinning their faith on things like the World Trade Organization. However, a little over 10 years later, by 2011, there'd been 450 cases. So it's in that decade, corporations suddenly went, bingo, this is the way forwards. Why should we rely on these great amorphous trade organizations between corporations? Let's just use the bilateral investment treaty. And there are now over 3,000 of them. Basically, the entire world has been tied down with these little bilateral investment treaties. How do they do it? It's actually a very small bit of boilerplate, legal boilerplate. You can download it. The most commonly used version is something called the model law, which the UN came up with, I forget when, mid-90s, I think. And all bilateral investment treaties basically just literally go to the website, cut it out, paste it into their agreement, and Bob's your uncle, you're done. And the bilateral investment treaty, before I tell you how it actually works, it's worth keeping in mind that it's not a piece of, it's not a diplomatic agreement the way that things are when you see Tony Blair and George Bush shaking hands, or, you know, Cameron and Putin shaking hands. A bilateral investment treaty is a piece of international law, which means that really it's not the province of your elected officials, it's the province of international lawyers. So it's quite a different thing, and that becomes very important in a little while. Okay, but first of all, what are they? There's only four parts to them, and each part in itself, I think you'll agree, when you first hear it, think, that's reasonable. All right, so there are four parts to any bilateral investment treaty. It says, you may not nationalize or expropriate a foreign corporation's business, okay? You must treat foreign corporations equally to your homegrown corporations. Again, what could be fairer than that? You must treat them fairly and equitably. I don't think anyone would think that was a terrible thing. And if there is a dispute between a foreign corporation and your government, you must accept that the dispute will be settled at arbitration. Okay, I'll tell you what arbitration is in a few minutes. But those are the only four parts to a bilateral investment treaty. This key, this thing, which makes trade agreements enforceable for the first time. All right, let's just go through them. No nationalization or expropriation. The classic example, which is always trotted out by those in favor of bilateral investment treaties and the trade agreements that now house them, is this one. And this is a real example. They say, look, imagine an American company goes to Africa, the Congo, builds itself a battery factory for making car batteries, and then there's some kind of revolution, and they either burn our factory down or they just nationalize it. And we, the American battery factory owners, we're out of a factory. That's not fair. Surely we should get some recompense. That's why bilateral investment treaties should be there. Fair enough. Because they've expropriated our factory. They just stole it from us. The thing is, you cannot leave a word like expropriation in the hands of international lawyers and expect the story to have a happy ending. Because expropriation over the last two decades has been expanded and expanded by the lawyers. So now expropriation doesn't mean that you just nationalized their factory, or you had a revolution and burnt it down, or just seized it. Expropriation now means the expropriation of a corporation's future profits. Not profits they've made, but future profits. To give you an example of what that means in practice. Do you remember after Fukushima, there was a great outcry in loads of countries around the world that said, well, we're not sure about this nuclear power. Particularly in Germany, there was a massive hue and cry amongst the public. And for once, the government, since it didn't have a huge majority, thought they would listen. So they put a moratorium on their nuclear power stations. Now, to me, whether you agree with it or not is beside the point. It is the operation of democracy, surely. The public expresses itself rather clearly. The government for once listens and says, OK. You'd have thought that was fine. They did something not against the law, and they did it democratically, listening to the electorate. What could go wrong? This is what could go wrong. Unfortunately, Germany's nuclear power stations were owned and operated by a Swedish company called Vattenfall. Vattenfall said, hang on a second. You've just put a moratorium on our nuclear power stations, and we were expecting to make about 800 million euros in profit. You've expropriated that future profit from us by having a moratorium. So they took them to arbitration, where they will win. Because it's very clearly the case that they were expecting to make those future profits. The government did something, didn't do something illegal, but it did something, and now they won't make those profits. That's what expropriation has come to mean. Which sounds pretty awful, really. And I wish, really, that was as bad as it gets. However, it's a lot worse. Here's something, a quote from something called In-House Defense Quarterly. I lead such an exciting life that what I often do of an evening is I read the the journals where the arbitrators, the lawyers who run arbitration, they're in-house documents where they speak to each other, and they're not expecting someone like me to be reading those things. So they're quite candid. So this is from 2010. They're talking about what bilateral investment treaties do. By way of saying, employ us to enforce your rights under a bilateral investment treaty and look at all the money you'll make. That was the nature of the article. So this is what it says. A bilateral investment treaty requires the host government to behave in a manner consistent with legitimate expectations of the foreign investor, to maintain the stability of the legal and business environment in place at the time of an investment, conditions the foreign investor would have relied upon when making an investment decision. Now, I think what you heard was wah 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 wah. Is that about right? And that's what they're relying on. Basically, what it says is the government can't change its mind about something. Whatever the regulations or the standards, at the time the foreign investor said, oh, we'll invest there, if the government has the audacity to change something, that would be the expropriation of future profits. So, for instance, if the law was you can have 400 parts per billion of benzene flushed out of your factory into the river. I'm just making this number up, by the way. And then sometime later, the government scientists say, do you know, that killed all the rats we did the experiment on. That's really not good. We think it should be half of that, down to 200 parts per million. That would contravene a bilateral investment because the cost of halving the amount of benzene they just flushed down the toilet would be expensive. And that will eat into their reasonable expectation of future profits, will it not? So in other words, you can have your government change regulations by all means. It's a free country. Have a vote. Elect someone. Go ahead. Make my day. But I'm going to take you to arbitration. And then it gets slightly worse. This is also for In-House Defense Quarterly from a little bit later. And it says, tax itself can be an expropriation. Don't you love those lawyers? Where it is considered not to fall within the bounds of internationally recognized tax policies and practices. Who would like to guess who decides what is internationally recognized? Who would make that decision, do you reckon? Do you think it could possibly be the lawyers? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. So in other words, let's say Ed Miliband jumps up and says, do you know what? if I'm elected, I'm going to have a massive windfall tax on the energy companies. Well, that would not be within the internationally recognised tax policies, would it? Because the lawyers would say, look, we look around the world and everybody else taxes us at 12%. And here you are saying you're going to tax us at 40%. Well, that's not what we expected. And you'll end up in arbitration, which is why I think we haven't heard Ed Miliband say anything more about that. Because I think someone tapped him on the shoulder and said, sorry, Ed, sorry, bilateral investment treaty, I don't think you can do that. And that's part of why I'm telling you about this, is because governments and political parties are very fond, especially in election year, of making you all kinds of promises, all kinds of declarations of the wonderful things they're going to do for you if only you will vote and put them back in power. Without them either, they don't realise, or they do realise, and they're just relying that you don't know, and so they're lying to you, because they can't do these things. And they won't do them, because they've already signed away that part of your sovereignty without telling you, which makes me personally extremely angry with them. So that's expropriation. Oh, but how about equal treatment? Okay, surely that's good. That you, it simply says, if we're a foreign company, we expect to be treated equally to the companies in your country. Sounds fair to me. However, that would knacker both the NHS and the BBC. Because if you're an American health provider and you're trying to make an honest or dishonest buck in this country, you're going to say, how the heck are we supposed to compete when you keep shoveling taxpayers' money into the NHS? That's a terrible subsidy, which they're getting and we're not. That's not fair or equitable. So it's going to have to stop. Now, Robert Goodwill said, look, there is nothing in the TTIP that says that we're going to, that the NHS will be privatised. It doesn't say you must privatise the NHS. And people like David Malone, they're just scaremongering without knowing what they're talking about. He's quite right. There is nothing in the TTIP that says thou shalt privatise the NHS and the BBC. There is no such words. However, if you are a government who likes privatising the NHS, then the TTIP will give you a pair of pliers, which means it will be irresistible for this reason. At the moment, the government can say, we're going to put these things out to tender. I think they put out something like 30 billion worth out to tender so far. And when it goes out to tender, the local health authorities have to then by law say, right, who can do this job? Put in a bid for us. And then they evaluate the bid and they can say, that private company gets it. Or they can say, well, actually this part of the NHS put in a really good bill, we'll let them do it. And at the moment, that decision is a local or national decision, right? In other words, your local representatives get to make that decision. Once the TTIP is signed, any foreign company that put in for a bid that is then turned down will have the right to appeal that. And the great thing from their point of view is they don't have to appeal it to the NHS, or to an NHS trust, or even to a local or national court. They go straight to arbitration. And when I've explained what arbitration is, you'll realise how awful that is. So no, the TTIP doesn't say you must, but if you want to privatise the NHS, it is the way to do it. So equal treatment, it isn't very good, because it means you can't have publicly subsidised things. You can try and have you can say, well, we'll just carve this little bit out and put it to one side. Yeah, fine. But once it's there, how long do you think it'll take a government to say, well, I know we exempted it from, I think that exemption should be taken away. How do you trust them not to do that? I don't. Fair and equitable. They're utterly meaningless terms. Oops, sorry. Fair and equitable. Let me give you an example. there was a petrol additive called MMT, which was used in the States. I've looked at the science that was used to grant it a license, and it's poor. It's very poor. I think there were just a couple of studies on a handful of animals. Just classically, awfully poor science. They wanted, Ethel Corporation, the corporation that sold the stuff, wanted to sell it in Canada. The Canadian officials, and the Canadians are not known for being, you know, radical Trotskyite nest of left-wingers. Their sciencey people, who were every bit as nerdy as everybody else's sciencey people, looked at the data and said, and it was a very, I forgot his name now, a lovely soft-spoken Indian gentleman, just a really good scientist who didn't like the cameras shining on him. And when you see him, he's like this. You can just tell he just wishes everyone would go away and leave him to his science. This was not a grandstanding man. This was a scientist. And he basically said, I've looked at the science and it's rubbish. And we're not allowing you to sell this stuff here, because what our estimation of the science is, if anything, it shows it's really not very nice stuff. So the Canadian government said, our man, our scientist, you're not selling it. Ethel Corporation said, that's not fair, that's not equitable, on the grounds, and figure this out if you can, that they said, you haven't got enough science to prove that it's not safe, because we haven't given it to you, and we don't have to. So they took them to arbitration, and they won. They won. And Canada had to allow MMT to be put in. They had to apologize to Ethel Corporation, and they paid them $315 million for inconveniencing them. Okay, that's what you get with fair and equitable. Which brings us to arbitration. Okay, and this is the bit, the last of those three dolls. The outside one just being the trade agreement, the inside one being this thing, bilateral investment treaty, and the last doll inside, the smallest of the Russian dolls, is this number four, accept arbitration. You may have heard it referred to in the press as ISDS, Investor State Dispute Settlement. They love giving things acronyms for the same reason that priests in the medieval period used to love speaking in Latin. They didn't need to, they just did, so they could condescend to you and say, you don't speak Latin, do you, madam? No, I didn't think so. Well, then run along. And the model equivalent in finance and international law is to give everything acronyms so that you don't know what the hell they're on about. And you think it's much more complicated than it really is. So, part four of the Bilateral Investment Treaty, otherwise known as an ISDS, what does it do? It says, all disputes must go to arbitration. Fine. You will sometimes hear it said, particularly by those in favour of the stuff, that it's a court. It is not a court. Arbitration is not a court because there is no judge, there is no jury. You, as civil society, have no representation there. Not only do you have no representation, but you do not have the right to know what evidence was brought. You do not have the right to know who brought it. You do not have the right to know the logic by which the arbitrators arrived at their conclusion. And you do not have the right to appeal. And I think that account, yeah, that's all of your rights. Enjoy them. The way that arbitration works is three arbitrators are chosen. I'll come to who an arbitrator is in a minute. The company that is in dispute chooses an arbitrator. The nation chooses another arbitrator, and those two arbitrators have to agree on a third. If they can't agree on a third, there's a mechanism for one to be imposed. Those three arbitrators sit behind closed doors and decide. And their decision is final and binding. In case you think he's just exaggerating again, he's making this up. Let me read to you a quote from a man called Fernandez Armesto, who is an arbitrator. That's his profession. Arbitrators are basically international lawyers, a very small specialist corner of international law. And this is what he wrote, must be about 5 years ago now. This is his quote. When I wake at night and think about arbitration, it never ceases to amaze me that sovereign states have agreed to arbitration at all. Three private individuals are entrusted with the power to review, without any restriction or appeal procedure, all actions of the government, all decisions of the courts, and all laws and regulations emanating from Parliament. Did I leave anything out, do you reckon? No, I don't think so either. They have the right to review anything brought before them by an international company. The international company doesn't like a law that you passed, a change in regulation, a temporary moratorium on the use of nuclear power stations. None of it illegal. No one's claiming that anyone's doing anything illegal. It's perfectly legal. It's perfectly democratic. And they have the right to take it to arbitration. As I said, there is no jury and there is no judge, just three arbitrators. These arbitrators, who are they? Well, I'm glad you asked. Because it turns out we know, wonderfully. The arbitrators are nearly all men, not all. They're nearly all from Northern Europe. Europe, not just Northern Europe. Europe and North America. What we do know is that they virtually all come from the top 20 law firms. Top 20, I just mean the world's largest, the biggest ones. The three top three who provide loads of the arbitrators are Freshfields in the UK, White and Case in the US, and King and Spalding in the US. Now, I've had small dealings with one of them. And I had a friend who worked for another one, and I asked him about these three, and his advice was, and so I shall pass it on to you, he said, if you ever get a letter from Freshfields, my strong advice is to change your name, emigrate, don't leave a forwarding address, and never be heard of again. They are extremely litigious. They are also not known for their pro bono work for single mothers, or for labour disputes, or for environmental work. They don't do any of that, so far as I know. Who they work for is the largest corporations, people like Exxon, or the large banks. So they live in a world where they go to restaurants, the kind of restaurants none of you would be allowed into. Probably not even just to wash up, you wouldn't be allowed in. So it's just 20 firms, okay? That's all. However, within those 20 firms, if you look at all the known cases of arbitration, and the reason I say known cases, because I'll come to it in a minute, but arbitration in some places is so secretive that they don't even let people know that a case has happened. So we could be in arbitration now, and if it's done at the London, the International Centre for Arbitration in London, you wouldn't even know, because they don't tell anyone. So, it turns out that from those 20 firms, 15 arbitrators, 15 private individuals who happen to be very highly paid international lawyers, 15 people out of 7 billion on the planet, have decided 55% of all known disputes and 75% of all cases where the claim was for more than $4 billion. Now, think about how many people we figure we need to represent us as a nation in Parliament. Several hundred, right? 15 people who you don't vote for, you don't even know their names, they get to decide everything. And you have no right of appeal. Now that is arbitration. So 15 people drawn from 20 firms meet behind closed doors and can review everything your parliament decides. Who are these people? Well, one of my faves is a man called Jan Paulsen. He's a triple national holding passports from Sweden, France and Bahrain, as I'm sure all of you do as well. Some years ago, I think three or four, he wrote a wonderful article in which, and I've got it, it's a personal favourite of mine, He was hopping mad about third world nations trying to regain control over their natural resources. He felt this was a moral outrage. I mean, the article is wonderful to read, but that was his opinion. And there's another man whose name I always get horribly wrong. One day I'll meet him and have to apologize. Karl-Heinz Bockstiegel. Reason I like him is whenever he writes about things, his favorite comparison, he always refers to companies as Goliath, as David, and the nations as Goliath. So you have Conoco, poor little David, suing the huge behemoth of Ecuador. It is sort of visible, I know, but the reason I bring it up is because it shows you that those 15 people who work for just 20 firms have a particular mindset which they share, and because they're the people that they meet day in, day out, they're the people they work with, they think this is fine. They're never going to meet you or you unless you're there to shine their shoes. So they're not in any way fair and equitable themselves. The arbitrators was one to walk in the door. They would say, well, you know, we go to arbitration where it provides a safety net of international law where there's no bias. They love this notion that they're unbiased. This is international law. Because what they like to say is, you know, national courts, they're always sort of beholden to the public or to the politicians, and you can't get a fair hearing in these places. And they bring up always the Congo. You know, how could you expect us, a poor innocent little company, you know, David Inc., to get a fair hearing in these horrible courts? Which, if you think about it, is basically just racist. It's just saying, us nice, upstanding, white business people can't get a fair hearing from the little brown people. You can't expect brown people to know how to run a court, right? So we need a court with white people in it, and then we'll be safe. That's basically what it says. But worse than that, and that's pretty awful, is our system of law like that? I mean, are our courts so crapulous that a foreign company wouldn't get a fair hearing? Well, one of two possibilities, there's only two possibilities. Either our courts are rubbish, in which case I think a reasonable question on your lips might be, well, then why the hell is that what we get to go to court in? Right? That's all. I mean, if our politicians think that our courts are so rubbish that we must sign the trade agreement so that foreign corporations can have the special protection of going to arbitration, why? Well, because they need to get a fair hearing. Well, then why the hell are you leaving us with third-rate courts, and those are the only ones we can use, Mr. Politician? Why don't you pull your thumb out of wherever you've lodged it and do something about that? That's one possibility. And the other possibility is actually anybody would get a reasonably fair hearing in a British court, at least as good a hearing as you'll get in anybody else's court, in which case, why do the corporations need something of their own? And it is this question that a colleague and I have submitted in evidence to the Commons Committee looking at the TTIP, saying, why is it you maintain that foreign corporations need to go to arbitration? What is wrong, if there's a dispute, with going through the British court system? Pray tell. To which we have heard no reply whatsoever. We've put the same question to the European Commission and to everybody else who listen, and none of them, you might not be surprised to hear, have said a dicky bird back. Because they don't have an answer. Either our courts are crap, in which case I suggest we get some pitchforks and storm Parliament and say, what the hell are you boys playing at? Give us a decent court system. Or our courts are fine, in which case there is no reason to give them their own special privatised court. One or the other has to be true. Nevertheless, that's what they want. And the reasons they want it are because, and this gets to what I call the unlevel playing field, if you have a dispute with an international corporation, let's dream up an example. Ooh, I know. Fracking is allowed, and foreign company gets given the right to frack. And then the nation comes to its senses and votes in a government which says, actually, we think fracking, let's just hold off on this. We think this is maybe not such a good idea. At which point, that would be the expropriation of future earnings, future profits, would it not? And we'll go to arbitration. Now, if you have a problem with a foreign corporation, the law of the land says you must seek redress through all available channels within the British system of law. So you go to the local court, you go to a higher court, you go to a district court, you go to a high court, you go to the Supreme Court and the law court and the law lords, which is now the Supreme Court. And after you've done all of that, and you better be a young person when you start this, and you better be rich. It's too late for you, sir, I'm sorry to say. You'd never make it to the end. Even if you had enough money to get there, you'd be died 10 years before you got there. And then maybe you'll be one of the chosen few who could get to some European level court. That's what you have to go through if you've got a problem with them. Say, you know, if they drilled something under your house, pumped 65 different chemicals, 18 of which had known or suspected carcinogens, left them there, and then your grandchildren got sick. Okay? That's what you'd have to do. If they have a problem with you, they don't have to go to court, do they? That dispute goes to arbitration. So here's this huge, long, cumbersome, lengthy business in those banana republic courts which the Britain is round for, and they just go, ha-ha, thank you, and we go straight to arbitration, which takes about 10 minutes. And in arbitration, three of their mates, working for the kind of law firms that work for them anyway, we'll sit behind closed doors and decide, and you get no right of appeal. How's that sound? That sound good? Good. So the obvious question is, well, why would anyone in their right mind sign up to this? And over the years, they've searched for reasons, and they've changed. The initial reason was the one I started with about the battery corporation. We need protection from countries where the law system, the rule of law, and the courts are not reliable. Okay, that is not the case with us. So why do they need us to sign one? So they've backed away from that one. Arbitrators very rarely use that argument anymore. Some of our politicians still use it. Why? I don't know, but they do. Then the next one, which is still being used. By people like that old windbag. What's the old Tory, used to be the Chancellor. Oh, what's his name? Smokes a cigar.
Lawson.
No, after him. Oh, he's still around. His name will come back to me. He's a dreadful old windbag.
Ken
Clark, thank you. It was the description windbag put you onto him, isn't it? Yeah, Ken Clark. He used this argument just a few months ago in the Guardian. Which it said, you must sign bilateral investment treaties because it's only countries that have signed them which give foreign corporations this special protection, which they so desperately need against the Goliath of, you know, your parliament. And only those companies that sign them will get lots of foreign direct investment, you know, companies investing here. Foreign direct investment, another acronym you'll see, FDI, foreign direct investment. And those countries that don't, nobody will invest. No one will invest here, and we'll all end up living in a ditch with poo on our heads. We'll be so poor. Right? That's what he said. Not the poo in the ditch bit, but everything else. Is it true? No, it's not. It's not true. How do I know that? Well, in 2003, the World Bank said, I wonder if this is true. And so they hired someone whose name I can't remember now. I've got it written down there somewhere. And she did a big exhaustive study looking at this precise question, and in the end she said, no, there is no correlation between the number of bilateral investment treaties you sign and the amount of foreign direct investment that you get. For instance, China doesn't have any of them, and it has more in foreign direct investment than it knows what to do with. Brazil has hardly signed any of them, and their main problem was far too much foreign direct investment. They were trying to find ways to beat them off with a stick. So there is no connection. Which makes you wonder about Ken Clark, and more, it makes you wonder about the editor of The Guardian. Now, that's 2003, and I'm a bloke who reads this stuff in his attic in Scarborough, and I knew. Now, either Ken Clark has been living under a rock, or more likely living in his gentleman's club, smoking cigars. And as it was before 2003, the last time he had consulted anything in the outside world. In which case, who the hell thought it would be a good idea to let some wizened flea bag of an idiot who absolutely knew nothing to pontificate and tell us what was what? Who thought that was a good idea? Or he had read it, and he isn't so stupid as I just made out, and he does know what's going on, in which case, he's a liar. If any of you can think of a third one, let me know, and I shall send him a written apology. After that 2003 study, there were three further studies, two from Yale and one from Tufts. Those are not, you know, small, insignificant academic institutions. They're major institutions. So the jury is not out. The jury is in. And the jury has quite clearly said there is no link. So that argument, the Ken Clark argument, doesn't work. So now what you hear all the time now is we need to sign bilateral investment treaties because that's what makes the trade agreement work, and the trade agreement will make us all richer. So don't get upset about this bilateral investment treaty or the investor-state dispute settlement or arbitration, because it's all necessary to have this wonderful trade agreement which is going to make us richer. Okay? This is what you will hear all the time. You will certainly hear it from all the politicians. You will certainly hear it from all the Tory politicians, because that was the briefing document sent out by Tory HQ to all of their MPs and me. I happen to have a copy. Written by Lord Livingstone, who is about as bright as Ken Clark. And what it says is that there will be a $10 billion increase in trade. This increase in trade will provide jobs and greater income, greater GDP, and we'll all be better off. I think they offer something like every household will be 400 quid better off or something. I can't remember the figure, but it's of that nature. And they present this, as Goodwill did, as just, this is the fact. It was carved on the tablets of stone just underneath number 10. There was a little addendum. It said these things were true. That's how they present it to you. It is not like that at all. Those figures, unbeknownst certainly to Robert Goodwill, and I suspect Lord Livingstone, come from a study that was done for the European Commission, and it goes under the acronym CEPR. And basically, it's a big mathematical model, same family of models that they use to do the weather forecast. They're called general equilibrium models. And basically, it's hundreds and hundreds of linked equations, and you put some data in, and they all crunch through the numbers, and then they spit out an answer at the end. All right? They built this model. I think it was actually built, an American model, if I remember rightly, from Purdue University. It's quite a while ago. General equilibrium models are dodgy models. They're not very good, which is why the weather forecast is so wonderfully accurate. And their model in particular is based, like most economic models, on pure gibberish. I have no regard for economic models, and no do most serious mathematical economists. One of the assumptions built into their model is this, and you'll see how wonderfully accurate it is. It says and it's built, when I mean it's the assumption, that means it's built in the way that the equations are made. It says that any part of the economy that shrinks, and therefore people lose their jobs, another part of the economy will automatically expand by the same amount and the same number of jobs. Now, if that were true, there would never have been an unemployed miner. In fact, there wouldn't be unemployment, would they? Because as soon as one factory shut, according to their model, another one would open up and you just get a job. But that's what's built into their model. So that should give you a warning of how accurate the models are, how like life they are. But nevertheless, this is the model they used, and they, if pressed, they'll say, look, there are even four different studies and they all show the same thing. And you'd think, okay, four studies all show, come up with the same answer, four independent looks at the same problem. That's pretty conclusive, isn't it? However, what they don't tell you, what they don't know, is those four studies all use the same mathematical model. So it's not, I know, you couldn't make it up, could you? It's not four independent studies. It's, here's a fruit machine, and person one comes up, puts 10p in the slot, pulls the arm, and it gives him his answer. And he goes, yay, and publishes it. He goes away, next person comes along, they put their 10p in, same machine, wouldn't you know it, gives it the same answer. Is that very surprising? If you put the same data into the same model four times, it'll give you the same answer. So it's not four studies that have looked at the problem. It's one model used four times. So, and it's a rubbish model. Yeah, it is a rubbish model, actually. Yeah, it is a rubbish model. Let's not beat about the bush. So finally, October of last year, October 2014, a man called Jeronim Capaldo, who has been working on trade agreements for a long time, he finally said, why don't we run the same data that everyone's using in a different model? So we'd at least now have another look at it, genuinely a different look. And he used another model. He used what's called the United Nations policy model. It's the model the United Nations has developed over the last several decades, which they use when they want to examine what Ecuador's policy or Germany's policy or our policy is going to do to the economy. It's what they use. So it's not a, you know, it's not something that someone got out of a cornflakes packet. And he put the same data into this model. So we're comparing like with like. All right? And this is what came out of that model. Same data. They found, when it spat out its results, that the TTIP would lead to losses in terms of net exports. Losses in terms of net exports. The TTIP would lead to net losses in terms of GDP. The TTIP would lead to a loss of labor income, would lead to job losses, 800,000 across Europe. The TTIP would lead to a reduction of the labor share. In other words, the amount, whatever the profits are from economic activity, the share going to the people doing the work, the labor force would go down. The TTIP would lead to a loss of government revenue, and would lead to higher financial instability and accumulation of imbalances. It's a winner. Now, the key thing is, you don't have to say, oh, well, that new model's so much better, because you don't know that. I've suggested to you it is, but you don't know that. So you don't need to go that far. And I don't need you to go that far. That's the key thing. All I need to prove, and I have, is that one model says this, and another model says that, diametrically opposed. And my job is done, because I'm not the one trying to tell you that I know exactly what is going to happen. But that's what Ken Clark, that's what this coalition government, that's what Labour is trying to tell you. This is where it starts to get party political. And they do it because they just look at this model, pretending this one doesn't exist. There is nothing which tells you that this model is right and this one is wrong, any more than the opposite. It's like having two weather forecasts. One says tomorrow will be sunshine and Skittles and rainbows, and it'll be lovely. So, you know, just your flip-flops and your Hawaiian shirt and you'll be fine. And this one says we're going to have a minus 30 blizzard. Now, if I know it's ridiculous, but if you did have two weather models and they did say those two things, would you think it was a responsible thing to stand up on the BBC and say, tomorrow will be fine, off you go in your little sailboat and your flip-flops? Would that be responsible? Or would you expect them to say, well, weirdly, one says it'll be fine, one says it'll be awful, I don't know. Be careful. That's the reality. Now, I personally think, and so do a lot of people, that this study is just a better study. It doesn't have those ridiculous assumptions, like, you know, the perfectly elastic employment in the economy. But the key thing is, those in favour of the TTIP just tell you they know what's going to happen, it's all going to be wonderful. They do not know. They do not have any firm evidence. They have one model which tells them that, and it just happens to tell them what they wanted to hear. Another model tells you it's going to be an utter disaster. Do you think it's right that the politicians should never mention this and just tell you it's all going to be wonderful and they know it's going to be wonderful? That is a lie. That is just dishonest. And that's their main argument for being in favour of the TTIP. The reason I call this the death of democracy is because everything I've just said, I think, is pretty appalling. I think it shows you that you're being lied to by people who are either ignorant or liars. I don't know which. And I've given you examples of how these arbitration is used regularly against corporate companies. A long list of known cases where there's one on fracking. Oh, I forgot to mention that one. Yeah. Did you know that Quebec once decided they didn't like fracking? They put a moratorium on it. It's not illegal. It's perfectly democratic. Lone Pine Resources, an American company who were fracking at the time, took Quebec to arbitration and Quebec lost. There you go. So you can tell what's going to happen here. But the point is this. At the moment, there's a whole range of things which your elected officials, your government, has the right to decide upon. You can say, we don't like this, we want you to do the following. You can choose between two parties, one of which says, this is great, we should do this, and one that says, we won't do this. And you can choose which one you want. You can get your government to change its mind. You can get it, your government to take notice of new facts and say, oh, actually, gosh, yeah, that's not right. We used to think thalidomide was a wonderful drug. I was one of those babies. My mother was that close to taking it. And then the evidence comes out and they say, actually, let's ban thalidomide. There's nothing wrong with doing that. And that's what we think, that's what we're used to democracy being about. The TTIP takes vast swathes of the things which are important for you to have democratic control and oversight, lifts them out of democratic control, says this is no longer anything you should have control over, and puts it over here on the other side of a fence and says from now on, lawyers, international lawyers will decide about this. Sure, your government can decide that it's going to put a moratorium on something. Sure, your government can say we don't like this particular chemical, we've decided it's not a good chemical, our scientists have told us it's not a good chemical. Sure, you can do all of that. But with the bilateral investment treaty, with the TTIP's clauses, all of that becomes empty. You get to vote for people, but they actually don't have the power. Because above them is this new power, the power of the arbitrators. So far in this country, power resides in three places. The people, that's what we had a revolution for, and we did have a revolution. In the courts, and a small amount left in the crown. With the TTIP, we create a new power, and one which arguably has greater power than all three, arbitrators, invested in three foreign nationals who you have no control over whatsoever, and they can overturn the decision of your parliament, and they can ignore whatever your court might say. And they certainly don't give a fig for the crown. Do you think that's right? Do you want that to happen? Because that's what will happen with the TTIP. It's very clear. It's there in the boilerplate legal prose. And it means that we will have a democracy in form only. Sure, you can vote for them. And they can strut up and down every 5 years and call each other names and say, yes, we think it's terrible and we think this is wonderful. And you can get all swept up in it and say, oh, yeah, that'd be great. And then, when they try to change something, a foreign company will say, that's expropriating our future profits, that's not what we're expecting, we'll take you to arbitration where three people you've never heard of get to decide behind closed doors and you have no right to appeal. Thank you for listening.